To the next case, Mr. Fitzpatrick, are you here? Would you like to introduce the people you brought with you?
I will. We have a delegation from the Open World Program, which is sponsored by the Library of Congress. The delegation are five judges from the Arbitrage Court, the Commercial Court of Kazan in Tatarstan, which is part of the Russian Federation. They're here for a week to learn about America's judicial system. Yesterday they had lunch with Judge Bauer, Judge Blum, and Judge Rosen. So, thank you.
I pause to say hello to my friends.
Well, we're very happy to have you here, and hope you enjoy your time in Chicago.
Welcome.
Thank you. And the next case is... U.S. versus Riebel.
May it please the court, counsel for the government, Todd Schultz, assistant federal public defender representing the defendant appellant. The 360-month sentence imposed in this case is procedurally and substantively unreasonable. District court properly calculated the guideline range, and the 360-month sentence that was imposed is within that range. This court has elected to apply a presumption of reasonableness to within-guideline sentences. This, however, does not mean that a within-guideline sentence is automatically reasonable because that presumption can be rebutted. In this case, the presumption is rebutted. The rationale behind the presumption of reasonableness is that because the guidelines are the product of national experience and empirical study, they provide a rough approximation of a sentence that would achieve the sentencing goals of the sentencing statute 18 U.S.C. 3553.
Counsel, I understand your substantive challenge. I don't understand the procedural error that you're arguing here.
We're suggesting that the court's weighing of the 3553A factors is beyond the bounds of reason, the emphasis that it put on certain factors.
Okay.
Such as?
Well, for example, in addressing the nature of the offense, the district court stated, in commenting on the seriousness of the offense, the district court commented that offenses against children as a category are the most serious and have no equal. And what this suggests is that the district court views all sex offenses against children as being the most serious and fails to look at the individual facts of a particular case and acknowledge that there is a wide spectrum of conduct, some more severe and some less severe. The district court simply says it's the most serious offense. And the reality is, if you look at the facts of this particular case, the defendant's conduct is limited to a two-week period in time.
How do you get more serious than the conduct displayed here?
Your Honor, I think it's important, and I think the court appreciates it, that I'm not suggesting that this isn't extremely serious. But to answer the court's question...
Well, if it's degrees, but he said it was serious, and you concede it's serious.
Your Honor, with all due respect, he didn't just say it was serious. He said it was the most serious.
All right. Then I get back to my original question. You tell me how it could be more serious.
Well, Your Honor, this occurred on 2 days. It could be more serious if an offender abused a child for a period of months or for a period of years, if an offender caused physical harm to that child. It could be more severe depending upon the age of the child. And so there are a lot of case-specific facts that the court simply ignores and makes a blanket statement that this is the most serious offense. And the facts that suggest that this is on the less severe end of the spectrum are the fact that there was no physical harm to the victim, that there was only one victim. And, Your Honor, significantly, this defendant did not possess any other child pornography. There were only 4 images involved. He did not use a computer, and he did not distribute them.
Well, the child was in his custody and care, and he lived with her.
That is correct, Your Honor, and he received a 2-point enhancement for that because of that. Your Honor, I would note that the district court, in justifying its 30-year sentence and talking about the effect on the child, the district court speculated that the impact of the crime would, and I quote, reverberate for a generation or two at least. There is no doubt, given how serious this offense is, that the child was harmed, but it does not follow that the child will suffer the severe lifelong trauma predicted by the court. And the reality is the district...
Was testimony to that effect needed?
Your Honor, I believe it is, because it is our position that the district court is obligated, as this court has said, to impose a sentence based on information with an indicia of reliability. And we believe that the district court's comments on this, a factor that it put extreme importance on, are nothing more than speculation. A reasonable inference based on studies cited to in the appellant's brief suggests that a conclusion would be the opposite, that this child would not suffer a lifelong trauma as a result, specifically, Your Honor, because of the limited nature and duration of this offense and the early stage of cognitive development that the child was at would suggest that this offense, while unarguably horrific, is not as severe as other offenses of this nature. And this rough inference is supported by the Department of Justice report, which is cited to you in the brief.
Mr. Schultz, I know that there was one case with the Eighth Circuit a few years ago where the Eighth Circuit reversed a guideline sentence as unreasonably high. Have we ever done so?
Your Honor, I'm glad that you asked that question. I believe the answer to that is that you have, but I think that gets to the heart of my concern, which is that it is a rebuttable presumption.
Where have we reversed as unreasonably high, substantive unreasonableness, a guideline sentence?
Your Honor, and I apologize, I could provide those cases to the court. I'm not able to reference those here today. I believe there are a handful of cases, and by that I mean 3 to 4. But I think what is important, and I would like to briefly address, is the fact that it is said that this presumption is rebuttable. And so that the court would ask, well, have we ever done it? It seems to suggest, in my mind, is it really rebuttable? And I think we need to look at, as I was stating earlier, why the court even elects to apply a presumption of reasonableness to guideline sentences. And the reason the court does is the court says they're a rough approximation of a sentence that would serve the sentencing goals of 18 U.S. 3553A because they are the product of national experience and empirical study. And here I believe everyone agrees that the child pornography guidelines are not. And so we're in a situation where the justification for the presumption simply does not exist. I mean, the reason that the guidelines call for such a high sentence is the result of mandatory minimums and congressional directives. And so I think this court, I would hope, would think about whether it even wants to apply a presumption of reasonableness in this case, because it's not required to do so. I'd like to talk briefly about...
Let me ask you, to what extent can a district judge in imposing sentence bring his life experiences and experiences as a judge sentencing people to bear on imposing any sentence?
Your Honor, I think that the court is able to do that, but it must be within the bounds of reason. And if the court is drawing conclusions which are contradicted by readily accessible, credible studies, then I do not believe the court is permitted to do that. In this case, one of the justifications that the court gave for the lengthy sentence that it imposed was its unsubstantiated assumption that there's no likelihood of rehabilitation for child sex offenders. And that's just not true. And the court said the most important...
Well, you say that's just not true, and I've heard the argument that there's no studies showing that sex offenders are any less likely to be rehabilitated than anybody else. But my recollection is that there are such studies.
Well, Your Honor, to the extent there are, they're not cited to in our brief, and I'm not familiar with those. But I would just note that the court, because of the unlikelihood of rehabilitation in its mind, which was speculation, viewed the need to protect the public as the most significant 3553A factor. And this assumption, while it may be based on the court's experience, is not based on the record before it, and as I said, is contrary to credible, readily accessible studies and information. And therefore, the great weight that the court placed on the need to protect the public is beyond the bounds of reason. I would also note that the district court appears to treat child sex offenders as a monolithic group. And this view is beyond reason because it fails to take into account that all sex offenders are not alike. And this court, in its opinion in the Garthis case, noted it is a mistake to lump together different types of sex offenders because some sex offenders, like the defendant, actually pose less risk of recidivism than others, and that he poses a lesser risk of recidivism is supported by the studies cited to in the brief.
Mr. Schultz, would you agree that the district judge in this case could have imposed a total of 60 years of imprisonment?
I do agree, Your Honor, and I'll address that. You're correct that the district court could have. I have two.
So that suggests to me that he was not lumping everybody together, but certainly not imposing the maximum sentence he could, only half of that.
Your Honor, correct. And I would just, 2 points on that. The PSR notes that under 3D1.2B that the counts grouped together, and I would suggest that why the guidelines do that is to avoid a situation where the defendant's exposure is driven by the charging decision. The reality is, in this case, if the government had wanted to, the government could have charged four separate counts, I believe, of production of child pornography. Therefore, the court could have sentenced him for anywhere between 30 to 120 years, and this court would presume a 120-year sentence to be reasonable if that were the case. I would also note, Your Honor, that the wisdom of the guidelines, which is no wisdom at all on this point, is at direct odds with the production of child pornography statute itself. And the reason for that is this. Congress set the limits, the mandatory minimum at 15 years and the maximum at 30 years. So Congress said 15 years would be appropriate in a child production of child pornography case, and conversely that 30 years would be reserved for the worst case. This is not the worst case of production of child pornography by a long shot, and we would ask that this court respectfully vacate the sentence and remand for resentencing.
Give you some time for rebuttal, Mr. Schultz.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You are a generous soul. You are a generous soul.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kit Morrissey on behalf of the United States. May I proceed?
Yes.
Counsel, Your Honors, the government respectfully requests that this honorable court affirm the sentence of the district court in this case. The district court clearly handled the sentencing hearing procedurally correctly. The district court found a correct guideline sentence, reached that over there being no objection by either party to the guideline calculation determined in the pre-sentence report. The judge then subjected that guideline sentence to the adversarial testing of the parties, weighed all of the 3553 factors. He systematically addressed each of those factors. And at the end of the day, he reached a sentence and weighed those factors in a way that was just different than the defendant would have preferred. The defendant here, through Mr. Schultz, states repeatedly that there's all this empirical evidence that's readily accessible to the district court, that the district court should have somehow magically been aware of. The point is that the defendant did not bring any of this readily available information to the district court's attention. The argument at sentencing was more of an argument that the factors should be weighed in such a manner that the defendant preferred. It certainly isn't the district judge's responsibility to surf the web and make mitigating arguments himself. That should have been the defendant's responsibility. Those arguments that are raised here were not raised before the district court. This court must consider a properly calculated guideline sentence to be reasonable, And the defendant argues that that reasonable sentence within the range was, that presumption of reasonableness was rebutted by him. He argues that he rebutted it in two ways. First, that the child pornography guidelines lack an empirical basis and skew the sentence toward the statutory maximum. He argued in his brief that the child pornography guidelines should not ever be presumed reasonable. Well, that specific argument was rejected by this court in both the Huffstadler case and the Pape case cited in the government's brief. And more recently, in the, I think it's pronounced Garthus case by this court, where the judge, Judge Posner, in that case, opined that that, you know, it's not, some of those arguments about the empirical data and the argument that child pornography guidelines should never be considered reasonable are better addressed to the Sentencing Commission. But the district judge is correct and acts appropriately when he relies on those guidelines in imposing sentence. That's what the judge did in this case. And I think that the defense also wants to take some of Judge Murphy's statements out of context. For example, he claims that the judge said inappropriately and not based on any particular evidence that this crime would reverberate for a generation or two. Well, what the district judge really was pointing out was that in this case there was a defendant who had been abused, not sexually, but physically abused and mistreated as a child, and the judge specifically pointed out that that abused defendant then became an abuser. That's what he was referring to when he talked about the crime of abuse tending to reverberate. He also pointed out that it would take a long time for the victim in this case to heal. Well, again, what the judge was really saying, if you read what the court said in context, was he was making a point that his sentence, which he believed to be reasonable, would assure that the victim would be an adult and substantially well into adulthood when this defendant got out of prison. The judge was going back to the two factors he considered most significant here in sentencing the defendant. One, the need for retribution, and two, the need to protect society from this defendant. That's what the what the judge was saying there. So,
which pretty much sums up all sentencing, but go ahead.
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. The judge here simply considered all the factors. Again, he went through them systematically. He chose to weigh them in a way that the defendant doesn't particularly like or the defendant wouldn't do. But it's not really for us to second-guess that decision as long as it was procedurally and substantively sound, which it was.
From,
we respectfully
from,
request.
Excuse me. From your perspective, counsel, could you distinguish the Miller case that was also also came from Judge Murphy that we sent back?
That case was, I'm sorry, Your Honor, that we sent back to Judge Murphy that he addresses. He mentions that.
Wasn't the sentence in that case, it had been an upward departure above the guideline range?
I think it was, yes. I believe he did. And, of course, this case was not an upward departure. It was, in fact, the low end of the guideline sentencing range. And as this court recognized, the sentence could have been up to 60 years imprisonment, and the government urged a higher sentence than the statutory maximum for any either of the individual offenses. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, we'll give you 1 minute.
Sorry, I appreciate the
thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.